Have you ever wanted to discover what's missing in your life? Metaphysics is available to all and is part of your life even if you don't know it. Welcome to Metaphysics, a view through the veil with Barb Crowley. Together we'll explore the mysteries behind metaphysics and how to use it to have a deeper understanding and advantage in life. And now here's your host, Barb Crowley.
Hi, this is Barb Crowley, and welcome to Metaphysics, A View Through the Veil. Today, we're talking to Simon Kenney. He is a researcher, author, technologist, and educator in Galway, Ireland. He has lectured at the University of Limerick and has written A Critical Introduction to Tarot, which will be available on December 8th, 2023. Simon, welcome to the show. I'm glad to have you here.
Thank you.
So I want to know first, you were an evangelical Christian. How'd you make it from that to Tarot? That's a hard leap, and you've got to go to hell on the way.
It's a good question, yeah. Well, between those two poles, I also became a sort of skeptic and scientific materialist, I suppose. Whenever I was growing up, tarot and anything associated with the New Age and occult wasn't allowed to be used or even to have in the house. So I was vaguely aware of tarot as one of those kind of practices or devices. It wasn't that there was a fear around it for me personally, but that there was a kind of suspicion, I suppose, and maybe on the converse side, a little bit of interest because of, you know, as happens with forbidden objects.
Right.
And then when I grew up, I left the faith. It just wasn't for me. It didn't make sense to me. And, you know, I became a kind of typical scientific materialist, even a little bit of a blowhard, not very open-minded, I suppose, about spiritual matters, as a kind of the pendulum swinging perhaps too far the other way. And then as I became interested in philosophy, I realized that there was, you know, a lot of questions that are very difficult to answer, if even they can be answered at all. And so that was the kind of context, but I was given a tarot reading, and it brought it up in my mind, just to, it prompted me to reconsider. It was like, well, what's actually going on here? So I had some, I studied maths and statistics, so I had some interest there in, well, what's going on statistically, and I thought maybe I had an explanation there. But later on, whenever I bought a tarot deck for a friend as a birthday present, I decided to buy myself one just out of curiosity. And when I looked through the deck, the images, there was so much symbolism from what I recognized from many world cultures. I also did a year of anthropology in college, which piqued my interest in all kinds of cultures in the world. I just wanted to look into it a bit more. And I read up on the tarot literature, and what struck me was that there wasn't much engagement with the philosophical basis for how the beliefs in tarot and tarot practice are substantiated. And so I continued to read and make notes. And as I engaged with the topic, I decided there's something here to actually to write about. So the book, A Critical Introduction to Tarot, is the result of that exploration.
And tarot started as a card game, didn't it? Without
That's
any
right.
Symbolism or parapsychology or anything, just as a card game.
Yes, in the 15th century in Italy. So it was at the Renaissance, and the people that created it were Christians themselves, pious Catholics. And there were, you know, there's the research is it's still being done on just uncovering the exact roots, but it's pretty clear that it was probably in Milan or one of the area in the area around Milan that it was created. And so being in this at the start of the Renaissance, the Christians were mixing, they're rediscovering, that's what the Renaissance means, they're rediscovering the classical classical philosophy and different beliefs, including astrology. And so what you'll see in the earliest tarot decks is a mixture of Christian symbolism and allegory, as well as those kind of astrological and other symbols of antiquity.
Some of the things from the card games have still made it through, like Trump's playing Trump in bridge and trumping, it was called, I think.
That's right. Yeah. So tarot, the card game of tarot is still played widely across Europe. It's something that people in the English-speaking world, in so where I'm from, Ireland, also the US and the UK, it's not widely played, but it's still quite popular across Europe, in, you know, Germany, Austria, Italy, Spain. And, you know, it was one of Sigmund Freud's favorite games. It's quite a complex game. It's a trick-taking game with trumps, as you said. Unlike bridge, there's a permanent set of trumps. So in bridge, the you use cards that are in the main, you only have the what is equivalent to the minor arcana in the tarot. So for your listeners, I suppose we can maybe review that the tarot is a 78-card deck. It has two sections, the major arcana, also known as the trumps, which are 22 cards. And then you have the rest in the like normally suited. So with four suits, like a standard playing card deck. So in bridge, it only has the four suits, and then trumps are taken out of that. But in tarot, the card game, it has a permanent set of trumps. Yeah.
What's it called in Europe? You know, the game itself, is it called tarot or is it?
Yeah, that's what it's called. So in depending on the language, so I believe in Austria it's tarock, in Italy it's tarocchi or tarocchi. My Italian pronunciation, it wouldn't be great, but the name that we call it, tarot, without pronouncing the T at the end, is the French version. And the reason why we have that in the English-speaking world is because it's mostly known as an occult object from the occult revival in France that brought it to the English-speaking world, pretty much largely through the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, where the most famous tarot deck was made. The one that springs to mind for most people will be that one, the Rider-Waite-Smith. But it's because of the occult association through France that we have it in the English-speaking world as tarot.
And how did it make it to the occult, from the card game to the occult? How did that happen?
So it was being played in France. And the story is that a guy called Court de Gelben, I hope I'm pronouncing that right as well, saw it being played by some ladies, so some aristocratic women, who and he apparently, the legend has it, saw it and instantly recognized it as the fabled Book of Thoth, the Egyptian book fabled to be written by the figure of Hermes Trismegistus. Oh, I'm really not pronouncing that well, but Hermes, who people thought was a real figure, who there's some doubt about that now, in the Egyptian occult tradition. And that's where Hermeticism comes from, through that study that would have been at the start of the first Christian millennium, so around, you know, 200-300 AD, and that's where medieval Hermeticism and alchemy comes through that line. But as the story goes, he discovered it, but it was being played widely enough as a card game at that time, as it still is in Europe. And then other figures in the French occult in the 18th and 19th century picked it up. So that Egyptian link has been pretty much disproven at this point, but it has been linked to Kabbalah, which is Jewish mysticism, and all kinds of other traditions as well, and reinvented over the centuries, really. It's one of the most interesting things about the tarot is how the longevity of the deck and how much it's been reinterpreted and reinvented as the centuries have gone on.
Although we still go back to that, the writer, say that again, the writer White?
Rider Waite Smith. Yeah.
Yeah. I know I was stumbling on that. Sorry. and that really was the artist and the publicist, right?
Right. So in order, it's Rider was the publicist. A. E. Waite was the sort of brains behind it, if you like. And then Pamela Coleman Smith was the artist, not to diminish her brains as well, but she was a very interesting character. Those were the people. So Waite and Smith were in the Hermetic Order of the Golden Dawn, an English magical society founded by three Freemasons at the end of the 19th century that was, you know, high ceremonial magic and secrets and rites and initiations and all that kind of stuff.
Okay, so now I'm going to be pretty open about my ignorance. What's the Golden Dawn?
So that's it. It's just a society. So I suppose like in the model of the fraternal societies, the most famous of which is the Freemasons. But there was a lot of fraternal societies around that time. It was a normal thing. But magical focused ones were maybe less common, but hugely influential on the contemporary Western magical tradition. Also, Aleister Crowley was a member, as well as W.B. Yeats. So some very famous members.
Mm-hmm. Going from the card game to the occult part, which some part of the world went to and some part didn't. What made that happen? I mean, you know, and why the cards? Why not coins or I Ching or I Ching, or, you know, why tarot and why has it gained such popularity?
It's a difficult question to answer. I suppose we can see that it did happen, and it's just wondering why. I think there's been a few different influences to that. Cards had been used for divination, certainly, independently of tarot. Some scholars say that the record shows, like the history shows, that tarot was used for divination at least at the 18th century. But some people think before that, because cards were in general used for divination. And in fact, people have used many things for divination, as you mentioned, all of those things. So it's likely just another object which has a chance component that can be used. So that's always attractive. So the way that things fall or the cards that come out, anything that can be randomly selected from or turned or anything like that can be used for divination, or certainly has been used for divination. Why the tarot in particular? The reason why it's potentially been so popular is because of the evocative imagery on it. The especially in the major arcana, they're really archetypical. So they show important aspects of our culture, and it's really quite a wide berth that they cover. So anyone who looks through a tarot deck, they'll be kind of struck by the resonances of the symbolism, if you like, the things that speak to them. And many people think that's because they speak to our, you know, innate, or some people say innate, other people might say cultural knowledge, and that it's easy to, or it's very attractive to make a narrative based on that, to see a sequence of cards as a story. And in fact, people have and do use tarot as a narrative device, not only as a divination tool. And the two uses are quite similar, because I suppose in a tarot reading, you're also telling a story of your life. But also it can be used, it has been used to create fiction and other works.
The symbolism in tarot, we have astrology's brought in quite a bit of symbolism. Are those in the original card game, or were they brought in for the divination part?
A lot of the symbolism was in the original, but in the original deck, the major arcana, those 22 cards, were the only ones that were illustrated with that kind of allegorical, highly detailed imagery. And the part of the deck, the minor arcana, that's similar to the card deck that we're all familiar with, let's say the poker deck, didn't have as much detail like the poker deck. You know, it has some, it showed the objects of the suits, but that's all. So in fact, many people think that in early days of tarot divination, only the 22 cards actually were used of the major arcana to do the divination because of that. But those images did exist at the time, and they were painted cards actually. They were painted similarly to how other larger works of art were painted, especially the kind of allegorical imagery. So, you know, for example, the death card, we see death in the Visconti Sforza deck, which is one of the first decks. It may even be the first deck. It shows death with a scythe doing a kind of dance, and with body parts in the ground. Or actually, I tell a lie, that's another deck. In the Visconti Sforza, it's death standing tall with a bow and arrow. And so even just having the figure of death there, that was something that was, you know, common allegorical imagery. You know, it's the personification of death. And then the star is one of in one of the earliest ones as well, and that would have linked it to astrology. And so there was certainly very evocative and archetypical imagery, but that's been expanded certainly in later decks.
Was, since it were painted cards, was it just a rich person's game?
Yes, that's the current belief, yeah. So it was aristocratic, yeah. People with leisure time and a lot of money. And in the context of Italy at the time, they would have been, you know, the up-and-coming merchant families.
What brought us into the era of mysticism, though? You know, where, let's say, in the 14th, 15th century, there was a shift from card to mysticism, it looks like. And why did they make that move?
That would have happened. I mean, they were pretty mystical, I think, in the 15th century when it was created. I suppose it was a time of the Black Death and lots of wars and so on, and they had very intense religious practices. But the kind of mysticism you're probably referring to comes in the 18th and 19th century in France, and it's hard to pin it down exactly how and why. But we know that it was used, and it's likely because of its archetypical imagery, the fact that it's transportable, and its use in divination. Because the more expansive view of divination is not fortune telling, like we might use the words interchangeably, but divination can mean contacting or getting information or just communicating with God or the gods. So depending on what your belief system is, it would be potentially a religious practice. And certainly some of the early tarot occultists in France were Christians, or their views might have been heretical, but they certainly operated within a Christian context. And that was also true for A.E. Waite, even though he was in a magical society that mainstream Christianity would look at with at least a raised eyebrow. He trained to be a Catholic priest and left the priesthood. And in his writings, it's very, very clear that he remained God-centered and the kind of God of Catholicism throughout his entire life. He saw his contribution as Christian mysticism in particular. So, you know, that's some of that context.
Right. I jump into Jung, but I kind of don't want to go there yet. What is the major arcana? I don't use cards. I don't play with the tarot, so I'm very ignorant to a lot of it. I apologize. But what is the major arcana?
The major arcana are the trumps in the tarot card game, but they are the in a tarot reading, they'll generally be the larger themes of life, and then the minor arcana will be the more everyday themes of life. So in one way of looking at the tarot deck, it's the higher realm, or the divine realm. So things that are going on in the higher calling of humanity, whereas the minor arcana would be the everyday stuff. So it's, yeah, I suppose those are the two answers, depending on how we're looking at it. If it's as a card game, they're the trumps, and otherwise they're the more important larger aspects of the archetypical imagery of the tarot.
And is it required? So when it first went into the mystical side, intuition was used. But can somebody do the cards without intuition? Or is it required?
I mean, if you were to ask a tarot reader, certainly all the literature points to that intuition is required. It's not a difficult thing for people to do, I suppose, is how it's presented, that, you know, we use our intuition all the time. It's just another kind of thinking. It's a kind of thinking that's more in tune with the unconscious or the subconscious, things that we just know, or that seem to appear in our minds without us, you know, searching for them as such. Things that thoughts and images that we allow to appear. So everyone has intuition, I suppose. That's what I think a practitioner would say. But there is an established body of so-called traditional meanings to each of the cards. A lot of that's based on the intentional creation of the deck. So that is that the creators of a particular deck, let's say the Rider-Waite-Smith, had certain associations in mind, and that's quite apparent to the in the construction of the cards and in the illustrations. And it's about maybe revealing that it's not all completely clear in it, and it's not intended to be clear. You know, A. Waite said that, you know, they contained secrets, and that's in fact what arcana means. The major arcana means the greater secrets, minor arcana means the lesser secrets. So like we would expect in any mystical tradition, it's about, you know, uncovering knowledge with our intuition, and discovering secrets and information that requires effort. So if we were to say what's the easy way to read the cards, that may not be worthwhile. It seems to require effort and study and openness.
Did Italy and some of the countries that are still using it as a card game, do they use it as a mystical storytelling the way we use it, or not at all?
I don't have wide knowledge of that, but I know that some do. For certainly, some do. I know that an Italian company that makes a cards called Fabula came out with a new deck called Intuiti, I think, and that was based on. It's like a reimagined tarot deck. They don't call it that, but it's used in that way. So I know that there's certainly knowledge there of it. But I wouldn't be very well aware of the proportion of people, let's say, playing it, and the proportion of people using it for divinatory purposes. That's a good question, though.
Is it used for divination in those areas at all, or a little bit?
I believe so. My yeah. Studies are focused on the English-speaking world, so I would be most familiar with that.
No, it's just odd that the English-speaking world went to the divination and the rest of the world kind of didn't, you know, stayed as a card game. It's interesting.
I suppose it's because it was mostly developed through the French-English connection and then onto America, where it's really flourished. And I suppose then... I would have to speculate, but I think re-imported to the rest of the world through the explosion of interest in American, certainly since the 60s, 70s.
Yeah. Now, Jung separated from Freud, his teacher, when he kind of went into more of the mystical.
Absolutely.
But they were both subconscious, into the subconscious. And
yes.
He believed that the information was coming from the subconscious, with the cards being used to help bring that out. But then again, Jung has an overlay too of the intuition and parapsychology as well. So he's the one that really started to pull this out, to make it more of a divination. Do I have that right?
It's you do. Although Jung wasn't too interested in the tarot directly himself, his views and his work has supported mysticism in the West, certainly since the time that he was writing and active. So his view was that it was the collective unconscious that connects all of the personal unconsciouses of people, which is where he differed from Freud. And it was certainly a more mystical view. And he himself had many mystical experiences where he thought that his dreams came from outside of himself, that he spoke with, that he, when he had a period of madness, really, in his life, he, a productive madness, I think he said, that, he spoke with figures that he knew were, in his unconscious, but that he didn't feel like were himself. So he connected that across people and across from outside of even people through this, the idea of the collective unconscious. It's been a really important idea for mysticism, and you'll find in almost every tarot book and magic book, witchcraft book, that it really adds like a legitimation to mystical practices, especially in light of what would be the more rational side of things that we could say associated with Freud, but also with the secularization of the world, the demythologization of our societies, and even people leaving religions and so on. So the New Age, I suppose, is about the rebirth of a more romantic ideal and mystical approach. And there's many offshoots of that. Tarot is sort of in that family.
Is it the popularity now, which is very popular, is it because of a loss of religion or belief, that people don't have a place to go? They're
That's
turning to tarot because, they're kind of lost. They've lost their foundation, their faith.
That's
faith
certainly.
In a bigger God or a religion, I guess.
Yeah, exactly. That's definitely the speculation. But there has been research done on this as well. I've seen it spoken about as the modern spiritual approach is like an unbundling of traditions, where it's a kind of syncretic mix. People feel freer to mix different traditions together in a bespoke spirituality for themselves. We see people talk about the path that they're on, and that path is unique and individual. It's really, not the same ideas as the orthodoxy of a religion, where it's like we're all on this one path together,
right?
And there's one right way and all of that. I would also see it as linked to overall cultural shifts in the kind of postmodern era that we're in. Postmodernism is a time where single grand narratives are challenged, and truth and history is seen as more fragmentary, and there's a greater emphasis on subjectivity as opposed to objectivity. And it's a difficult thing to to pin down and understand, even because it's so fragmentary. But that's part of the context, I believe. And let's say during COVID, there was a lot of, we would see news articles all over the place about how people are coming up with new spiritual practices, especially in the really difficult times. And I suppose that's when we really see it, whenever people have a great need for support and answers, and you know, people are suffering, is whenever we see the most engagement maybe with spiritual practices. And so the proliferation of witchcraft, especially of a kind of self-care aspect, and you know, self-empowerment,
control, isn't it? Need for control. Exactly. Yeah. And need for
and
answers.
Security. Yes. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Magic in many forms became very important over the last 3 years. With the
what magic
insecurity.
Is, I suppose. What magic is at its base is power, and the ability to act in ways that are extra physical, maybe, but it's about that empowerment. Yeah.
Now, do the cards have power, or do the cards give people power?
That is the question, isn't it?
Yeah.
So in a critical introduction to tarot, I review those different answers to that question. Perhaps more people see it as more of a conduit for either personal power that can't be accessed consciously. So maybe that comes from the unconscious. And again, maybe through that from the collective unconscious, or maybe it comes from the person's spirit or a spirit realm, or maybe it comes from even outside the person, maybe from spirits or the gods or whatever. It depends. It's one of those things that's very much up to the person's interpretation. Actually, tarot readers are really more interested in that it works rather than how it works. It was one of the things that prompted me to write a critical introduction to tarot, was to try to get a bit more beneath the surface, because most tarot books are more like practical guides. There's usually a bit of speculation on why it might work and so on, but not as much. It wouldn't satisfy maybe a philosophical approach. But whether or not the cards have an inherent power is, it's a difficult one to answer. But probably most people would say that it comes through the cards, because at the end of the day, we can pick up a card and look at it. It's made out of cardboard. These days, it was made in a factory somewhere. You know, how does it work that gets imbued, or indeed anything else? You know, whether or not it's a pendulum or a wand. So most people would see it as a focusing of energy in some way.
Do most people believe that it's tapping into the unconscious, their unconscious, their subconscious, or a greater, you know, as Jung said, a collective unconscious, or God?
It depends on who you ask, I think. And I think that there's a little bit of slippage, or maybe actually a lot of slippage, between all of those different explanations. People do tend to hold that a bit lightly, you know, like that it's, well, it's a bit of this and it's a bit of that. Because, you know, if it goes through the collective unconscious, that's maybe whenever we see something that happens very uncannily, and we may think, well, I couldn't have known that. How could I have possibly known that? So it
like
does
a synchronicity type of...
Exactly. Another one of Jung's ideas. And so it begs the question, and it makes people wonder about it. But certainly the most commonly written about explanation is the psychological explanation, that and that opens the door to the collective unconscious. But let's say the purely materialistic answer would be that they allow us to reflect on things, and they actually bring things up for us. We project our unconscious onto the cards, and it helps us to understand ourselves better. And then whether or not that actually connects to events that we couldn't have known or that are outside of our own personal unconscious is the thing that's, I suppose, always tapping at the door, the kind of patternicity that makes you wonder. And it's probably, yeah, I think certainly one of the things that keeps people interested.
How accurate is Thoreau? Has anybody ever studied that or tested that? Or
there was a parapsychology lab called PAIR. I can't remember what the letters stand for or where it was, but it was a U.S. university for sure that was studying parapsychology, and they were able to determine that. And I believe it wasn't very well respected, that their findings, that there was something to it. That it hasn't been substantially questioned, especially not empirically or scientifically. If you ask a tarot reader, they'll have their answer. And it's usually, you know, that it works very well. But, you know, one of the things that I was most interested in is, like, how does the belief itself support whether or not it works or not? One tarot writer wrote that if the person who is getting the person who the reading is for, often called the seeker or the querent, if they don't believe in it, or if they're sort of trying to test you to be like, well, does this work? I don't think it works, but I want to see. If they don't come at it with a good attitude, basically, then it doesn't work at all. So there's a kind of, and I believe that they said it was an exchange of trusting energy, actually. So that there's, you kind of need to be up for it and to be there and present for it to work. So because of factors like that, obviously that makes it very difficult to empirically test, because how do we establish whether or not your intentions are aligned? What is that actual trusting energy? Is that euphemistic? Is it or metaphorical, or is it any sort of real energy or any, you know, it really is, it's difficult to pin down. And I think that's why we're not seeing people winning millions using the tarot, is because all of those things, they don't work in that way. And any tarot reader would tell you the same.
That's almost like, if it doesn't work, blame the victim. You know, well, like you did it wrong. You didn't. Yeah, you didn't have pure thoughts or something. Yeah.
Yeah, I suppose it's the confirmation bias. It would be that where whenever it works, we say, "Oh, it works because it works." And then when it doesn't work, it's like, "Oh, I must have done something wrong." Or we ignore those. And so, yeah, it is an area. In a critical introduction, there's a chapter on the statistics to do with it, in which I review some of those kinds of questions. And I was very interested in an idea of the tarot author and scholar, actually, T. Susan Chang, who wrote that we have to sacrifice our doubt in order for it to work. I thought it was a really interesting way to put it, that you need to sort of suspend your disbelief in order for it to work. Again, not something that's very testable, but if we look at tarot as, even for the materialist, as a kind of meaning journey, then that makes all the sense in the world, even from that most skeptical viewpoint, that you know, you can't really create meaning from something without that, at least a little bit of trust.
Except that if it really works, it should be able to work without belief.
Exactly.
In other words, you know, if you sit down as a skeptic, you approached this as a skeptic.
I did. But we could dig into that a little bit, because it depends if how it works requires your consciousness to be engaged in a certain way, then it would still be that it really does work, as long as that's the case. So the example that I would use is like a toaster. So if we think that there's little people inside a toaster and they have flamethrowers and they toast the bread that way, if I put it down, if I push down the button on the toaster and the bread comes up, I can be like, oh yeah, they cooked it. And it seems like, well, that's fine. But the toaster also works if I don't think that the toaster is going to work. I push the button down and then the toast comes up, it's like, then I'll be surprised that it doesn't work, and it'll sort of prove me wrong. So it works no matter if I think some nonsense about it, or if I even don't believe that it works. That's a kind of brute, mechanistic kind of technology, works that way. But things that involve our consciousness, if they do involve our consciousness, then it's certainly reasonable to expect that they require some conscious state. And it's one of the angles that I explored, and it's one of the areas of reasonable doubt for me, is that it all really depends on what you think consciousness is, how does it work, and what that implies about the fundamental nature of reality, you know, with a metaphysics, something I assume that you're very interested in based on the title of your show as well.
Yep, that's our deal, yeah. You have approached this from a mental, you know, very intellectual point. What is your personal opinion?
My personal opinion, I'm still my study of tarot didn't challenge my fundamental beliefs, which are, you know, I would be a scientific materialist or a physicalist. But I think that at a certain point, when we're talking about metaphysics, I'm a philosophical skeptic, not just a skeptic with a capital S. You know, in fact, I'm not a skeptic with a capital S. That kind of skeptic that looks for ways to disprove things and is kind of on the rampage to to show how silly people are and how their brains don't work very well. That's not right. Really
not quite neutral. Yeah, not approaching it in a neutrality.
Exactly. And I think that is actually real skepticism, like philosophical skepticism with a small s, which is just that we wonder if there can be knowledge at all. Like if we can, how do we know things, and can we really know things, and can we know everything? Is everything knowable? So I would assume, and again, at a base level metaphysical assumption that I'd make is that not everything is knowable. And at a certain point, we have to make a decision about what seems reasonable to us. So for example, if we want to determine, is the universe or is reality just physical? Is it material? Does it have a dual nature? Is there the physical world and then a spirit world? Or maybe is it only mental? You know, is what we see as physical, is that actually a projection in consciousness? So that would be idealism. And there's some interesting work being done at the moment in philosophy, kind of reviving idealism with, you know, links to quantum mechanics and all of these different kinds of things. Yeah, I find them.
Want to give the definition of idealism?
Yeah, it's just the idea that that the true reality are ideal forms, and that what we have is a sort of projection. What we see in the physical world is a projection of those ideal forms in some way. So there's different kinds of idealism, I suppose. The idealism really comes from Plato, an ancient Greek philosopher who had his idea of perfect forms. Yeah, there's different variants on it, but that would be the gist. How I would split up the main, and again, it's a huge oversimplification, but those kinds of three main kinds of metaphysics, that there's physical world only, there's physical world and spiritual world, or there's only the mental world, which is, you could say it's the same as the spirit world, that there's only spirit or mental world. For example, that there's one mind, that there's one consciousness, and that we're all just part of that in some way. It's a very difficult thing to obviously understand, and many much ink has been spilled in the process of trying to make it intelligible. But from that point of view, you know, it really opens the door for a lot of weird stuff. And I suppose that's what parapsychology and the paranormal studies into that try to show, the edges of where what seems to make sense breaks down and opens up the door for potential other explanations. You know, if it works 99% of the time, how do we account for that 1%? And that's certainly where I would have enough doubt to continue to be interested in many different answers to questions that I maybe have a provisional answer to, but that I try to keep open-minded.
What percentage is accurate? Is, you know, do they say, oh no, that's spot on? What percentage is that? Because I mean, with our eyes open, we can't get 100%.
So, in a tarot reading?
In a tarot reading or in any kind of reading.
I don't know. Really, like it's, I think it's highly dependent. Like I was saying, I think it's highly dependent on the practitioner, on the kinds of readings they do. So I can't answer, but I think for a competent tarot practitioner, it would be a high percentage. I don't know. Maybe it's 80%. Maybe it's 70%. But yeah. It would be individual. It's not a scissors. You know, it's not a can opener. It doesn't work that way. And I think that either we say that tarot doesn't work at all, or we say that it works in some way that's very highly contingent on external factors in some way, in a way that more physical technologies aren't.
Science has, there have been quite a bit of scientific experiments, and science has really gone into mediumship and reincarnation and parapsychology and psychic, you know, and they've done quite a bit of real scientific experiments with that, but never tarot. Any idea why that is? That's kind of odd, I think.
Yeah.
But maybe they didn't do I Ching either, and I didn't notice. So I don't know.
I think that this is my own speculation, but I think that one of the things that drives that kind of research is the areas of practices which take advantage of people, or potentially do. And I think that mediumship and psychics are one of the areas that people are most wary of. Because in a tarot reading, you're most likely to hear, you know, looser information. But with, and maybe we're contacting the dead. That's one possible explanation for how tarot works. Maybe their spirits are telling us what happens, or maybe it's either your ancestors or other deceased people's spirits. But mediums are explicitly connecting with the dead, and so it's something that's a little bit more it's a little bit narrower maybe, and it's a bit more testable. So but it's also something in which people are taken advantage of a lot. You know, there's a lot of scams out there for that, and it's one of the reasons why skeptics with a capital S are on the rampage, is, you know, ostensibly as a way to sort of protect people, I suppose. And so I think that those two angles would be my speculation. One of them being that that it's an area where people are taken advantage of, at least potentially. And it's also a little bit more narrow and more specific. We don't, like, there's no good grand theory of how tarot works, but contacting spirits, like if I contacted someone in my family, let's say my grandfather, then I would know things about him. You know, he would know things about me. So that would be, it would be pretty clear, I suppose.
Right. And then you get into, and what's telepathy? What's right. Happening with the cards, and what's telepathy, where you know that information?
Yes.
And can exactly. You project it to the cards to right, make it? Right. Feedback to you.
Yeah. I know. And I suppose there's a kind of psychological telepathy, if you like, in kind of cold reading and those kinds of techniques that are not very mystical, but that are ways in which we communicate. You know, it's genuine communication in a way. You know, it's reading body language, it's all of that, but it's obviously not good faith.
And that's why I'm surprised it's never really been tested, you know, in a scientific way.
Maybe it's something that could be proposed to an interested party, for sure.
I'm proposing it to you, an interested party. There you go. You know, we're going to have to wrap it up, and I want everybody to know where they can get hold of you and where they can get hold of your book.
Absolutely. I can be reached on simonkenny.co, which is my website, or on Twitter, skenwrites, skenwrites. And you can buy the book on amazon.com or amazon.co.uk in the UK, or on Barnes & Noble as well in the US.
And can they pre-order?
They can pre-order it now, and it'll be released in the EU on the 8th of December and in the US on the 1st of January.
Thanks so much for being on. Fascinating conversation. It was great not to have to just talk about the technical, but the whole idea behind Tarot and what is it? You know, what is it? Thank you.
Thank you.
It's been great. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you for joining us for Metaphysics, A View Through the Veil. Please tune in for another edition with your host, Barb Crowley, next Friday at 4 p.m. Eastern Time and 1 p.m. Pacific Time on the Voice America Empowerment Channel. Enjoy your upcoming weekend.